I think that especially as a woman in medicine, there's a lot of guilt and shame about your work, especially as it relates to your career. And you feel like you're kind of getting it from both sides of, I'm just not good enough, or I'm defective as a mother or as a spouse. And then I just would say to that person that you are doing such important work. You are loved. You are your child, even if they can't express it to you in this moment, is proud of you and is so lucky to have a parent who not only loves them and values them and is brilliant, but also is going to be so proud of who they are and is going to have all these doors open to them and these resources open to them because of the hard work that you've been through.
Welcome to Moms of Medicine. I'm your host, Allie Trainer, and that was Dr. Laura Vodder. She is a GI oncologist in Indiana who focuses her non-clinical time on humanism and well-being in medicine. I have been looking forward to interviewing Laura for a while because I have been following her on social media and have gotten a lot of inspiration and support from the things that she posts. We talk about so much in this conversation, and I can't wait to share it with you. We talk all about writing her first novel and how she's currently working on getting it published, having her daughter in medical school, breastfeeding her daughter for 2.5 years while being an internal medicine resident, her family's decision to have her husband quit his job and be home full time, her presence on social media and what it means to her and why she keeps doing it, and finally, the inspiration and motivation behind creating a really exciting new project she's working on called the Life Support Community, which is to support people in medicine with really anything that we struggle with. So definitely worth checking out, and I put the link in the show notes. I loved this conversation. I learned so much, and I think truly it's a must listen for not just moms, but really anyone in medicine. Laura has such wisdom and insight, and this is a conversation I will not soon forget. Laura, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me. I know we were just chatting a little bit before I started recording, but for people listening who may not know you, if you could just share your name, a little bit about what you do for work and a little bit about what you do outside of work.
Yeah. Well, Allie, thank you so much for having me. I love your podcast. I wish this resource existed for me when I was in my training. So I am Dr. Laura Vodder. I'm a board certified medical oncologist. So I'm an internal medicine trained doctor. Now I work as a medical oncologist. I take care of patients that have gastrointestinal tumors, so mostly pancreatic and colorectal cancers. I work at the Indiana University Simon Cancer Center here in Indianapolis, and I've been out of fellowship now for about 2 years, and I just love the work that I get to do. So that's my clinical practice. And then outside of that, I'm really a writer at heart. So I do a lot of narrative medicine writing. I write fiction. So I've finished a novel, not yet out in the world yet, but I am working on my second novel now. And I also do a lot of advocacy for essentially making the field of medicine more human for both patients and clinicians.
I love that. If you can share with us too, I know you have a daughter. How old is your daughter right now? And when did you have her in your medical training?
So I had my daughter when I was pregnant all of my third year of medical school. And I had my daughter at the very beginning of my fourth year of medical school. My husband and I got married right before medical school. So okay. 3 months before I was 25. And I think a lot of us, at least for me, I was thinking, oh, my mom had me when I was 28. You know, I've got plenty of time thinking. And then I take embryology as a medical student. And all of a sudden I'm hearing all these things like mitotic non-disjunction, and you're learning all about infertility. And so I had a mentor that said to me, you know, there's really two good times. There's never a good time to have a kid. It's either medical school or fellowship. And so my husband and I were really trying to decide, were we ready to have a child this early? And turns out that we really didn't want to wait. And so I ended up getting pregnant my third year of medical school, going through really all of my clerkships, surgical rotations, OB-GYN rotations, even my sub-internship, which is kind of like for those of you who may not know, it's kind of like a mini internship. And then I gave birth to my daughter like a week after I finished my sub-I. Wow. I had most of my fourth year. I was able to build all of my vacation to my fourth year and have online electives and lots of research courses. And so I ended up having 8.5 months at home with my daughter, my fourth year of medical school, before I jumped kind of back into 3 months of clinical and then started intern year.
Okay. That's amazing.
And now she's 7. Yeah. Okay. We'll be 8 this summer.
There's so many things I want to ask you already, because you dropped some super exciting news about your novel, which I know you had talked about a little bit on your social media. And I definitely want to ask you more about that and the fact that you're already writing your second one, which is super exciting. So I'm definitely going to ask you more about that. But first, I just wanted to pause because I thought that was super interesting advice that you got, that the time to have a child was either medical school or fellowship and not residency. And I was hoping to get your perspective on that from two aspects. One being that you're someone who's gone through fellowship and gone through medical school, had your child in medical school. And then also as someone who speaks a lot about clinician health and well-being and kind of your thoughts on that in terms of timing of having a child and how it worked out for you. And then your just like larger perspective on it.
Yes. First of all, it's having a child is not so easy to plan and predict, right? So you can come up with this perfect timeline and then it may or may not work. I think that's the first thing that can be so for a lot of my friends right now who are dealing with infertility at this point in their career, that's the most frustrating thing is it's not predictable. And I don't think that there is a great time to have a kid. Having a kid in medical school, the benefits are, and I think the reason my mentor told me this is that the benefits are there's no one that has to pick up my clinical practice on maternity leave. I'm not responsible for patients. There's nothing that I have to do that I'm truly responsible for. So when I step away from patient care, no one else has to cover that time. It just makes it easier to have more time and more flexibility, at least in the way that things work in the United States.
Yeah.
I think that for me, it was really hard to be an intern and to know very little. You know what that's like to be an internal medicine intern, Allie, and what that feels like jumping in and doing that with a child that was 11 months old. She turned one in July. So that first month is when she turned one. And then of course I was a PGY2 and she turned two. And so every year she kind of followed me with her birth date as I transitioned. And I have a very supportive spouse and we can talk about how important that really is. But I think that jumping into residency and having a young child, that comes with its own challenges of, you know, we can jump into those as much as you'd like. I also, as you mentioned, I finished my fellowship and every fellowship is different. You did a Pulm Crit Care Fellowship. I did a medical oncology fellowship. I still had a lot of call and a lot of clinical responsibility in my fellowship. We did calls for a week at a time and it was home call. And so we got a lot of overnight calls for a week at a time. And we did that 10 weeks my first year of fellowship, I think 6 weeks my second year of fellowship. And then it kind of gets easier. But there's still a lot of call in fellowship and you have your own patient panel. So these are patients that you're responsible for that if you step away, they're still attending physicians and other fellows that can help cover. But it has its own challenges, right? It's really hard to step away from patient care when you need that time to bond with your child. And for those of us who choose to breastfeed or, you know, there's a lot of challenges that surround that. And so residency, I have friends that did have children in residency. I think if you're part of a big residency program, it's more doable because there's more people to share shifts and move things around. But what ends up happening is you work a lot of your shifts, really hard shifts while you're pregnant.
Yeah.
And there's challenges to that. If you're sleep deprived or stressed or overworked, there's that potential for pregnancy complications. And that's pretty well documented in the literature too. So when you're done in practice, you know, maybe that's the best time. But again, I have colleagues now that are having kids and I support them and I love that. Again, I have a colleague that's having a baby in September and we're already, okay, September to January, we're rotating who's going to cover her clinics. And so it's just, we're working it out and we want her to have that time with her kid, right? But it's the hardest thing about clinical medicine is there's not a perfect time. It ended up being the best time for us. I only have one kid. We were going to think about having a second kid and then the pandemic hit and there was just so much that happened. And by the time the pandemic was over, we're like, well, gosh, our daughter's getting older and we're actually pretty content. And
that's awesome.
We're a one kid family. We never thought we would be, but we are. And at least that's where we are right now. Yeah.
There's so much in there I want to delve into. One of them, you mentioned the decision to breastfeed. And I know you've spoken a little bit in some of your writing and some of your social media posts about that. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you were able to breastfeed your daughter for 2 years. Is that right?
Yeah, for about 2.5 years.
Congrats. That's amazing. And just to say too, I know there's always, it can be a stressful topic for anyone who can't or chooses not to. Of course, anything is okay. I know that you were an intern during all of this. And I just, for women out there who it's meaningful to them and they want to, how in the world did you do that for 2.5 years? I'm so impressed and just logistically blown away.
Yes. You know what? I am so grateful for women in my life, friends and family that breastfed their kids and breastfed them breastfed them for a long period of time. My sister has three kids. She breastfed all of them, anywhere from each of them for a year and a half up to 2.5 years.
Wow.
And one of my two best friends also exclusively breastfed their kids. And they had all had kids before me or around the same time. And so my sister, when I was, you know, in the hospital, had just delivered, she came in the next day. She's like, "This is how you breastfeed." I'm like, "I can't do it. I don't know. This is uncomfortable. This is weird. Why is it not working?" And she's like, "Well, try this position." So she was like my lactation nurse, my sister. So I have to give her so much credit. And she just made me feel comfortable doing it. She's like, "Breastfeed when you're eating." And so I'm like eating an omelet and I'm breastfeeding. And so
that's amazing.
She helped me out early on. And of course, there's always that discomfort that comes, and knowing that that's a bit normal and having the right, you know, topical ointments and things, and then you push through it. And then it becomes the most, to me, became the easiest thing on demand, feeding your kid, don't have to heat up a bottle. And so I was lucky to be home with my daughter for 8.5 months before she went to, and I actually would go out to the grocery store things, but I would never leave for more than a couple hours. I had one overnight wedding that I went to that was fine, you know, but during that period, I was basically breastfeeding her, pumping some and trying to build up supply and things, but really just breastfeeding her. And then when I did my clinical rotations in medical school, again, as a medical student, you're there to learn and you're important, but you're not an essential person that has to put in orders. And so I had a rotation in the ER and I just said, "I need to go pump." And so I had periods of time to pump in my radiology and my ER rotation. And then I pumped. And then my daughter was a year old when I started intern year. And from that point on, I stopped pumping and I just fed her on demand because she was eating solid food. You know, we had introduced cow's milk at that point in time. She also would drink some plant-based milks too. And she was in daycare, and we still gave, you know, some of the breast milk as well that she would take, but we really did exclusive breastfeeding for about a year plus table food. And then she was eating pretty good table food by that point. So then I just fed her on demand. So I'd work all day. And the beautiful thing, I didn't know, so I'm just saying this for those people that may not know this. Once you reach a certain point in your breastfeeding journey, it's not painful. You don't like get that, you know, what's called engorge, where you're just like, "Oh my gosh, if I don't pump this second, it's going to be so uncomfortable for me." And so I could work all day as an intern and then come home and just feed her on demand. So I would, you know, feed her, and then she'd run up to me, she'd nurse as soon as she would see me, and then we would play, and then she'd usually nurse again in the evening. And then if I worked a 28-hour call by the time I was a second year, you know, sometimes it'd be 30 hours or even 40 hours before I'd feed her. And it was the same thing. We just feed on demand. And we do know that even an ounce of breast milk can help with their immunity. So if she'd pick up a cold, you know, like, she never had an ear infection. She was in daycare. It was a nice benefit of work, a resident working 60
days
a week, being able to come home. And if I couldn't be there all day, being able to, my body to produce antibodies for her while I was away, I thought that was really cool. And so I was able to really just feed her on demand until she self-weaned at about 2.5. So
that's amazing. And I think really helpful for you to say all of those things, because my son, he'll be 2 in July. So I'm also a July baby.
Oh, congratulations.
And yeah, thank you. And I breastfed him, I think, until he was 15 months. And I stopped because I was going to be starting my attending job and I was going to be doing overnights, and they start at 5 p.m. and end at 8 a.m. And I'm like, well, I guess it's done. But now to hear you did 28-hour calls and you just still did it on demand and it worked fine, I think I'm glad you're putting that out there, because I went through it, I did it, and I didn't know. And so I was like, we gotta stop, because I'm not going to be here. So that's really good to know, and so nice to not have to worry so much about the daycare sickness.
Or just days at a time. I have friends that would go on, you know, and again, the benefit of having good friends that breastfeed their kids is they'd go on a 3 or 4 day trip. They'd come home and they weren't sure. They're like, "I don't know if my supply's gone or not," and it wouldn't be. And right. And they could like, and it's that feeling of like, it's amazing to me that the breast milk can still be there. Even if you're not pumping, it really can sustain for a while before. And probably, I don't know what the data on that is, and everyone's different, but just knowing that even if it's just once a day or once every other day, that it can provide antibodies, and it, you know, it's not uncomfortable. It's just very natural.
Yeah. That's amazing. I want to ask you a little bit more too about your relationship with your spouse and how that has played a role and kind of evolved throughout your journey. You mentioned that you guys got married right before you started medical school. You make this decision to have your daughter. And again, I told you before we started recording that I've been following you on social media for a while, but did a little bit of a kind of went back and did a deep dive on some of your posts. And you've posted some really beautiful, but also really hard things. And there were two that really struck me. One was you shared this post about, you know, when your daughter was really little and her really crying and being so upset when you would leave. And now she just plans a fun date with her dad. And that one to me, I just wanted to share because like I'm still in that hard moment sometimes where it's so hard. But it's so nice to know that there's a light there. And then there was also one you posted more recently about you two making the decision for your husband to not work full time and be full time at home. And there were some fascinating responses to that. I would say overwhelmingly positive, but some really vocal negative comments. So I just wanted to hear a little bit more about how you two came to that, how things evolved, and also how you took some of those comments and kind of, yeah, how did you respond to all of that?
Yes. So such good questions. I think that it was a huge process for us. My husband worked for a long time supporting us financially when I was in medical school and residency and fellowship. And then my daughter was home with me for 8.5 months, but then she was in daycare. She was in daycare and we were facing the decision of her going to kindergarten, her having to do before care and after care, which we had done for a long time of just, you know, doing our best to on our days off or picking her up early or, you know, dropping her off late. But there was a lot of wanting to spend more time with her and wanting that time to be at home. And so then when I stepped into my attending career, we made that financial decision that, again, we live in the Midwest. We live in Indiana. Cost of living is very low. We have the ability to do that on a single academic physician salary to be able to live below our means. We bought a house in medical school that was, you know, below our means, and to live simply and to not spend a lot of money and to spend money on, to us, experiences and travel, but to really try to save and to live as much as we can humbly and frugally so that we can do that. And so now my husband stays at home with my daughter after having really supported me extensively in training. He did a lot of, when I was on night shifts, of course, you know, night shifts and yes, overnight calls and home call. He's such a good father and has poured into my daughter's life and really, you know, just loves her as she is and has just been very supportive in my career. And the same is true, just valuing her as a little person, right? Yeah. And so that's been the decision for us. But it was very, very hard when my daughter was little, because of course you have this bond. Probably the hardest thing was when she went first to daycare after being home with me for 8.5 months. That was, I mean, just tears every day. And my daughter is very sensitive, very compassionate, very smart, but very sensitive. And so that was really, really hard for me. And even questioning, should I even go to residency? Should I wait a couple years or should I delay this? And ultimately I watched my mom go through medical school when she had 3 kids, when we were 11, 9, and 6 when
she
started. So she went through residency from when I was, she was in training from when I was in basically fourth grade until I was a sophomore in high school. So I watched her go through it. My husband was very supportive and it's what I really wanted to do, but it was hard. And the days that you're experiencing right now with your son, where he's like gripping onto you and screaming and you walk out and you're just like high stress, your heart rate and your blood pressure's high. And right. Just knowing that your child will absolutely be so proud of you and love you. And that season passes. And now we went to an event this past Friday, a fundraising event for our cancer center. And my daughter, my sister-in-law and her kids come over and play. And I was like, honey, we're leaving. She's like, didn't even look. She's like, bye mom. She didn't even hug me. She's just like, stay out for 5 hours. Stay out late. Like, you know,
that's just amazing.
It's just beautiful to see it evolve. Like we have a very close relationship and she knows that she's loved, but she absolutely, it's just a season of their development, that really hard separation anxiety, and it does get better.
Yeah. It's like makes me tear up a little bit. It's like helpful to hear that because I'm literally like peeling his arms off of me, passing him off to his daycare teachers who love him and who he loves. But I'm just like, when will this get better?
It's so hard. It's so hard for so long. It's so hard. Yeah. And I also wanted to let you know too, that comment you said about people interpreting, anytime you write, you're putting your life online, your personal life through this podcast, anytime. The reason I started my online, even being online through social media, I had none of that through med school. And then I had my daughter and I felt there are no other women in medicine who have kids. And so I was really looking for community and found it on that platform. And then it kind of has developed to what it is. But there are people that will say just very mean things about people they've never met and will judge, especially men, for their roles to stay at home. And I don't read those comments. So if they're out there, I probably haven't read them, to be honest with you. I try to just ignore them because there, if you spend too much time, what is Brene Brown talks about this a lot, because after she gave her first TED talk, people just came at her like you're overweight and who are you to talk about shame and all of these really cruel things they said. And she really has talked a lot about, you know, if you're not in the arena, meaning if you write that Roosevelt quote, if you're not in the arena, then I don't care about your opinion. So if you're not a person that is in medicine and has a child and is making decisions about the best decisions that are for your family, then I don't care about your opinion. And then she also says a comment that says, you know, you're not the jackass whisperer.
You know, like, I love that.
You cannot put yourself out there in any capacity and expect it all to be supportive and bubbly. It's just not reality. But I think other men need to see that that can be a possible pathway and it can be a meaningful pathway.
Absolutely.
And it allows me to be able to do the work that I do. I probably wouldn't be having this conversation with you today. My husband isn't, he's going to get my daughter off the bus here, you know, in a little bit. Right. And so it's just not possible to do the work that I do without his support.
I love that. And so you started talking a little bit about your kind of impetus to start your social media account and really speak to people on there. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that and kind of how your relationship with it has evolved, or maybe it's stayed the same. But I know for me personally, and for anyone out there listening who's not following you, I love your Instagram account because you post these really beautiful reflections on, you know, what you're going through personally as a mom and a woman is in medicine. And you repost these really inspirational quotes that, I don't know, I'm a sucker for inspirational quotes, so I love them. And then really sometimes just funny things about, like, it is comical sometimes the things that we do in our day-to-day life. So I personally find a lot of joy and inspiration from it. So anyone out there who isn't following, you should definitely follow along. But how did you kind of get into this and what does it mean to you now and what keeps you going?
Yeah. So I initially had no social media presence for a very long time because I was worried how would that be perceived, you know, getting into medicine and going through medical school and all that. And then I had my daughter and I felt I was home with her for 8.5 months. And in many ways, it was extremely isolating. And in many ways, one of the hardest seasons of my life because my daughter was colicky for 2 months. She was an early teether. Teeth popped at 2 months. We didn't know she was teething. She was highly sensitive. She just wanted to be on my shoulder all the time. Like, she would not be happy unless I was carrying her. And so much of that season of my life was like breastfeeding. And I live an hour from my family, but everyone in my family works or had kids. And it really wasn't. And my daughter would just scream if she was in the car. She wasn't like that. I'm gonna fall asleep if I'm in the car type of kid. So it was a hard season of my life. A lot of it, my husband was at work. He was supporting us financially. I was home by myself taking care of my daughter. And it was it's a hard season of life. And I think that I didn't anticipate that. I thought that, well, yeah, pre-med was hard and med school was hard and this, you know, but yeah, it's going to be fine. And it was, but it was just a hard season of life. And I was looking for other women who were going through something similar in medicine. And so that's actually why I started, at least just as an observer on social media, finding other women in medicine that were talking about similar things and just connecting with them. And then kind of I've always been a person that journals and likes narrative writing. And I had started to come to that in medical school when I was on my clinical rotations. And it really became almost like a micro blogging platform for me to just capture the things that were happening and trying to share just in case it helps someone else feel a little bit less alone in what they were facing. And I think that's really what it's continued to be. I think it's evolved as I've gone through my own training and realizing that there's a lot of things within medical practice. My mom is a primary care physician and I have a lot of friends in this field. And there's a lot of things that clinicians, nurses and physicians and APPs face that a lot of people don't know about and you don't know about until you're in it. And so I'm really trying to find a way to encourage those who are in this, but also finding ways to help make meaningful change, raise awareness for both mental health advocacy and the well-being of clinicians, and really trying to continue to see our patients as human beings and allow us to retain really meaning and purpose in our work as clinicians. And that's a lot of what when we write, you know, we talked about narrative writing and novel writing. That's really what I keep coming back to. My characters are clinicians and they're dealing with mental health and they're dealing with the hassles of practice, but they love their patients. And there's right challenges that I think that my page has evolved from just, let me find a community of women in medicine to there's so much more here that I want to talk about and write about. And that's really how that page has evolved.
I love that. And I am dying to hear more about this novel, whatever you're willing to share. Yeah, really anything, how you started writing it, kind of where you are right now. I'm just amazed that you were able to do that while also being in medical training and then being an attending.
Yes, it's so funny how the world works. My first idea for a novel came to me when my daughter, I was like sleep deprived and waking up at all hours with my daughter. And the idea came to me almost through a dream when my daughter was 2 months old. I'm like, out of all the times in life where an idea can come to you to write a novel, like that's not really the most ideal time in life from a person that's never, ever written a novel in my life. But I thought, you know, I can self-teach myself this. So I did all the master classes that through that app about writing. I read a lot of books about writing and then I started just to write. And it was a very long process. The first novel took me about 7 years to write. I worked with a professional editor. I finished the novel and I am at the point where now what happens is either you self-publish or you try to find an agent. An agent is someone who represents your book and tries to send it to publishing houses for publication. And so I'm in that process now. I've had a few agents. So you send them out in batches, like five here, and then you wait and then five more. Okay. So now I'm in the process of, I've sent some out. I've had a few requests for either partial or full manuscripts, but I'm kind of waiting to see if there's an agent who might take me on as a client. It's like a one in probably like a 4,600 chance, like really tiny chance of getting an agent your first time around. So I'm just kind of tabling that for the next year and letting that process evolve. And in the meantime, I'm working on my second novel.
Amazing.
Which, you know, I think I'd love to at some point in the future, if these come to fruition through publication, I'd love to talk more about all of that. But the process has just been a little bit every day, almost like chipping a little bit of the marble of a sculpture every day, of just a tiny bit amount each day. And really my training really inspired the first novel. And now my kind of attending practice has kind of influenced the second novel. So
that's amazing. Well, I really hope it gets picked up because I'm dying to read this book. Oh, so
thank you.
Good luck. Keep me updated.
Thank you.
I'm wondering too, if you could talk about, you know, you speak a lot about clinician well-being and wellness, and you also have a really busy life. You have a 7-year-old daughter. You're an oncologist doing clinical practice at an academic center. And I think, you know, sometimes there's this tension between, you know, being dedicated to your job, being dedicated to your family, also making time for well-being and wellness. And sometimes it can feel overwhelming and almost counterproductive because you're like, well, you're not doing all these things and you're also not paying attention to your wellness. And it can, I think sometimes for a lot of people, I feel like I'm in a decent spot right now, but I've definitely felt that at times. I'm like, I'm supposed to take care of my family and do my job. And then now I have to take care of my well-being. Like it gets a little challenging. And you seem to be, you know, outside perceptions are definitely not everything, but you seem to be in a really good spot and able to be dedicated to your family and your job and also pursuing these passion projects. And there's another one that we got to talk about too. But you know, what has your experience with that been? And how would you talk to people who are maybe struggling with that?
I think most of us in our training, I don't want to speak for everyone because programs are changing, but I think a lot of what it feels like in training is survival.
Right? Yeah.
Getting from day to day, you're working 12 to 14 or 16 hour days or sometimes longer, overnight shifts, 28 hour calls, and you work 12 days before you get a day off. And it's really just, you're waking up every day and you're really in survival mode. And I'm throwing as much as I can. And I've got this big lunch bag and I'm throwing in like a whole avocado and a whole bell pepper. And I'm just like keeping, I'm just like throwing in what I can. That's not going to take time. I'm throwing it over my shoulder. I'm doing steps on call. I'm doing whatever I can just to maintain my health as much as possible. I'm sleeping when I can. That feels like survival in many ways. And there are tips and tricks to try to help in that season. But I think it's a very different story now that I'm out of training. I hope that anyone listening to this that may feel still that level of overwhelm in their clinical practice, I just hope that you know that you have more value than you realize, more negotiating power than you realize, and more options than you may realize. And it's different for everyone, right? I work again in a place that is a very good cost of living. And I have 3 full clinic days a week, which ends up still being a lot. And I still end up doing notes on other days. And I have 3 tumor boards a week and I do academic stuff. So I'm on committees and I have meetings and I do other things. Academically, I'm still full-time, do a lot of teaching and things, but I work very hard to keep my priorities clear and to try to say no as much as I can so that I have time in what I call the margins. I have times on my non-clinical days to write. I have time to be with my family. I have time to exercise. I know you're a runner, right, Allie?
Yes.
So I would show you right now. I have a walking tread right by my standing desk.
No way. I'm jealous.
I can show you. I don't know if you're doing this or not.
Yeah.
You see my walking
tread? Oh, yeah. Oh my gosh, this is a great setup. She's got a bike and a walking treadmill.
Yeah. So I've been trying to be really creative. If I'm home and I'm not in clinic, I can usually get 4 to 6 miles walking.
Wow. That's amazing.
Just at like 2.8 to 3 miles an hour. I usually do about an hour cycling. I like to go outside and do exercise outside, some running, some hiking. And I try to eat mostly a plant-based diet. I feel like these are habits I've been trying to create for a very long time, but I think really what it comes down to is when you're in practice, you have more control and you're going to be asked all the time to do more things for free. That's especially if you're a woman in medicine, but really getting clear on what matters to you. And I had a good mentor that called it buckets. So she said, you either need 2 or 3 buckets. So my buckets are GI oncology, kind of this humanism in medicine for doctors and patients, right? Making the field of medicine more human. That includes kind of clinician well-being and advocacy, and then writing, narrative writing and fiction writing. And so if I'm asked to do something, does it fall within one of those 3 buckets? And it allows me to say to myself and to the people that are asking me to do this work, yes, I'll be on this wellness committee for our university or for our school of medicine, because that's important. Or yes, I will give this talk about compassion in medicine to our residents. Or yes, I'll give this grand rounds on this topic. Or yes, I will, I'll write this piece for this medical website about this thing for physicians, because it fits within one of those buckets. And of course, just because it fits in a bucket doesn't mean you have to do it, right? I've had to say no to a lot of really good research opportunities, and I still enroll patients in clinical trials, but I am not at the point where I can write grants and write research protocols and spend all of my extra time doing that, because I have to choose. And so I think if you're listening to this and you can figure out what those buckets are, that can sometimes be one of the hardest things, just to figure out what are those buckets. And then being able to, if someone asks you to do something that's outside that bucket, and say, I really appreciate this opportunity. Thank you for considering me. However, it doesn't currently align with, my goals and priorities at this time. And I don't have the bandwidth for this at this time. And of course, especially if that's unpaid work. And so it's really hard, but especially when you're coming out of fellowship, and especially if you work in academics. But I think that's something that I'm still trying to balance. How do you become a team player? How do you say no? But I think a lot of wellness really comes down to working less and having more time in the margins, time to exercise, time to sleep, time with your family, weekends free, being on call less. And I think that we still need doctors to take care of our patients, but we also need doctors who are going to be able to stay in these fields and work for decades, right? And so some people might say to me, well, you only have 3 days a week of clinic, but I still do inpatient service. I still do call. I still do weekends and I do academic stuff. And, but some people might say, well, if you took care of patients 6 or 7 days a week, it's more patients that you can care for. But at the same time, that increases my chance of burning out and leaving the field of medicine altogether. So I think that every person is different based on your financial needs and your family and your personal desire for how much you want to work clinically. But just know that you have options. You can negotiate. You can leave a practice that doesn't work. You can negotiate less time and to not feel guilty for doing so.
Yeah.
That has been a key for my well-being.
Yeah, that is great and super helpful. And I'm curious to how your relationship with saying no has evolved, and what you've kind of learned along the way and any tips you have for that. And now I'll preface that question too by saying, I remember when I first reached out to you, you were like, yes, definitely interested. But in the summer, I keep my schedule light to spend time with my family. And I was like, yes, this is amazing. Like, now I really want to interview this woman. And also, I need to start doing that. Because I know for myself, I love the buckets analogy. Because for me, a lot of the times I would try and choose things that fit with what I wanted to do. But then also, if there was a free slot in my schedule, I would just say, yes, 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 yes. And I love, love, love your idea of protecting the summer or whatever time is important to you, and your transparency with saying, hey, this is why I'm saying no, or this is why I'm saying later. So how did you come up with that? And any other tips you have along those lines of ways to say no or later and feel confident and good about it?
Yeah, Allie, that's a great question. Thank you for, I remember this now. So I, as a fellow, as a resident and a fellow, I gave, when I was a fellow, I gave about 130 talks that year.
Wow.
Sometimes three a day when I was on service. I remember being at the VA, like doing a bone marrow biopsy and being like, I got to go give a talk. And then like doing a virtual talk. This was kind of like when everything and I had a lot of people, wonderful people reach out to me through social media being like, hey, can you give my AMWA group at my med school to this group of 20 women a talk? And I'd be like, yes, I want to do this. And so I would do that. I would say, I said yes to absolutely everything because I wanted to share all the wisdom that I had in a way that was conducive to others. And I wanted to just keep pouring into lives of others. And I wanted that opportunity. And then it reached a point where I was like coming home late because I was catching up on all these extra things that I was doing and having to write patient notes later. And then it just got to the point where I was like, gosh, I want to do these things, but I have to find a way to do these things that are sustainable. And so I came up with really trying to figure out, I used to do these things on my clinical days, and sometimes I still will give a virtual grand rounds on a clinic day, but I've set a new boundary. That's no talks on my clinic days.
Yeah.
Because I would be like, my patients would be late and I'd be like, hurry up. I have to get downstairs, and my internet's not working. And then you're sitting there and you're like, why am I doing this to myself?
Yes.
And so I think it's really creating those boundaries for yourself. And so when I give talks or I get to share things get to connect with people like you on podcasts, or I do other things, like I have two talks this week. I'm giving a talk on compassion and this week. And then I'm giving a talk about physician well-being on a live keynote. It's going to be in Dallas, but I said, I can't go to Dallas. Right. And so it's just like figuring out, but then we're traveling to some conferences. I'm giving the commencement address in San Diego this year. So it's
congrats.
Being selective about yeses and no's. And now my family comes to those things with me. And so it's like negotiating so they can come. And then what we've decided, so my daughter is now in school, which means that she's not in daycare in the summer. She's at home in the summers. And of course, my husband's a stay-at-home dad, so she's at home. Mm-hmm. And so my non-clinic days, Tuesdays and Fridays, those are the days where I usually do all this extra stuff. And in the summertime, those are times where we can go swim, or we can, you know, go do the children's museum, or we can go do activities. And so I used to just fill all those days up with stuff. And then she'd be at home, like watching her iPad, or she'd be like, they'd go swim. And I'd be like, oh, I should have thought ahead so I could have that time. And it's not that things that come up in our lives aren't priorities or important, but I think that if they can wait, if it's something that we can shift a little later, I've really started to almost try to clear my complete schedule in the summertime on those non-clinic days. I still have tumor boards. I'm going to still have patient pages. I'm going to still have people that have urgent needs, and I'm going to be there for those things, but I'm going to try to push all the other things as much as possible to the academic year. And so that helps to protect that time that I have with her.
It's brilliant. I love it. And along the lines, talking about, you know, your passion for well-being and how you're really making an impact in this space, you have a really exciting project that you just launched that I would love for you to share with the listeners.
Yes. So I was, just as we were talking about, I was trying to figure out how can I provide a resource in a way that is streamlined to people that are looking for it. So on a daily basis, I probably have anywhere from 10 to 15 people reach out to me through social media. How am I competitive for HemOnc fellowship? Going into my first year of practice. I'm so nervous. I have imposter syndrome. What do you think? I'm trying to get into medical school. What do I do? I'm facing severe sleep deprivation in residency or mental health or all of these things that people reach out to me for. And I used to spend about 10 or 15 minutes per person and just either dictate answers or reach out to them because I wanted to serve the community as much as possible. And then it just got to a point where I just couldn't do it in the same capacity. And so I was trying to find a way that these questions that keep coming up, parenthood and medicine and, you know, how do you make decisions about having a child and when, all of these things, I wanted to have a platform that was streamlined. And I was trying to figure out where to do this. You can do it through things like YouTube, but I didn't want to create video content all day. You could do it through a podcast. And I love that idea. We seriously thought about that, but we decided against it. And so, and I'm a writer and I really love written content. And so it's almost like a blog with options for live streams. And we're doing this through Crowdcast and Patreon. And we're basically, there's a small subscription fee to help pay for these services. Right. And so it's this service that allows us to, every week I provide some type of written guide. Like this week, tonight we're going to have a question and answer live stream. And it's also going to be a guide that launches your first year in clinical practice. Here's the 10 things that you need to think about when you get a bad review, when a patient chooses a different doctor.
I need that guide.
When you have a patient that is saying really rude things to your nurse, what do you do? And when you have a medical mistake and when you, right, how do you transition? How do you create office relationships? How do you engage with? And so really it's just like a how-to guide, the things that I wish I knew. Like the platform is the things that I wish I knew a decade ago or a year ago. And so it's really meant to be a resource for those who are looking for it in a way that's streamlined and organized in a way that makes sense with the structure of my life as I'm trying to set up for protect my own well-being. So I can show up regularly, but instead of, okay, this person wants to, I'm going to give a talk to these five students about this topic and where's the Zoom link and what day is it and what time, right? And so
it's a lot.
This is where I'm showing up and this is where we're going to answer questions and hopefully it's going to be a resource, but it's only been about a month since we've launched it. And so it's really exciting and it's still in its infancy, but it's really starting to build steam. I'm excited. Yeah. About it. And it's called the Life Support Community.
Okay. Yeah. If you don't mind sharing the link with me, I can put it in the show notes so that people can find it a little bit easier. Yeah. I can email you afterwards for it, but that way people can find you. I also just have to comment too. I love the whole meta aspect of you're so dedicated to wellness that you're spending so much time talking to all of these different people who are messaging you that it was kind of encroaching on your own well-being, but then you found a way to make both things work. And I just love the full circle moment that is.
And I think it's really hard as a woman in medicine to think that your time or your resources you provide are valuable. Right. I even said to my husband, I was like, well, I'm just going to do this, but I'm going to do it all for free. And he's like, well, you're spending about an hour or two every day, every week, like building these guides and putting your effort into all of these multiple hours. And you're showing up for an hour. Like, and it's charging us a fee to use these services. Like you should probably, your time is valuable and should be compensated. And I think that we're so used to saying yes to things that are free and just extra work on our time. And so I think it's really important to know that your time is valuable. And if you're spending time doing something that you think is important that others find valuable too, it's okay, right? To allow it to be an extra resource to you because it is your time, right? And I think that's something that I still struggle with.
Yeah, no, it's hard, but I think you're being a good role model because I will say as someone who has benefited greatly from the content that you've put out there, your time is valuable and making an impact. So you deserve to get compensated for it for sure. I feel like we've talked about a lot of good things. I'm a nerd. I took some notes. So I just wanted to make sure I didn't miss anything wanted to ask you about. This is a little bit of a switch gears, but I think maybe goes a little bit along with what you were talking about with knowing your value. You wrote this post about a pre-med advisor telling you you wouldn't get into medical school and then ended up taking 3 gap years. And now you're an oncologist, you're really making an impact. And I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about, I know we talk probably maybe sometimes too much about the imposter syndrome, but it impacted you enough for you to put a post into the world talking about that. So I just wanted to hear a little bit more about kind of what that meant to you. And especially now in reflection, when you are doing fine and you are succeeding, like in retrospect, was that motivating to you? Or are you like, this is a problem. We should be uplifting people more and motivating people if they have that desire.
Yeah, I think that when I was an undergrad, I knew so little about what it was to get into medical school. So I was a science major at a very, very, I went to Notre Dame and I was taking classes with, you know, future PhDs and rocket scientists, right? People that were going to really go onto the PhD path. But yet there was also this pathway that you could do pre-med, but also then be a psychology major or a business major. And so I think I just took the hardest of the hardest possible pathway. When my classmates were taking really hard, you know, organic chemistry, I was taking really hard organic chemistry and then two other science class, right? And so I just was studying all the time, 16-hour days, every day of the week, and was just really, really grinding and was doing well. But when I met with my pre-med advisor, right, they have a certain, and this is just true for all schools, is that their pre-med advisors are successful when they have a good percentage of the people who apply get accepted. Right. And so even though I was doing volunteer work and I was making good, decent grades, right, I was taking really, really hard classes. And just know that it's not that these advisors have bad intentions, but they don't know you. And just because your grades are not perfect, that doesn't mean you're not extremely smart to be in the classes that you are and doing everything you are doing. And medical school was way easier for me than pre-med, honestly, like the science classes, because I had just been grinding for so hard for so long. And so I was very discouraged because I thought I took that as gold. I thought that his advice that I wouldn't get into med school meant that I really should take a separate pathway, when really it was most likely that at that moment in time, the probability would be higher for me to get in if I had a higher GPA, even if that meant I had taken easier classes. And maybe if I didn't get in, it would make their school statistics look not quite as good. So maybe there wasn't a whole bunch of motivation to encourage me in a different path. And it allowed me to do a lot of self-reflection, and I took a lot of global health courses and got involved in that my last year of school, and really got interested in public health and global health. I ended up spending a year teaching in Haiti and doing volunteer work there. And when they had the cholera pandemic, really, our school helped out with that. And then I did a 2-year master's in public health and really thought about doing a, you know, PhD or a DRPH doctor, you know, doing more policy work and health policy and public health work and global health work. And I really, when I was taking my classes, we would always talk about all these diseases and all of these people experiencing these diseases in cohorts. And I really wanted to take care of an individual person as they were going through illness. And that became very clear to me. And then I had had a research mentor. I had had research publications. I had a master's in public health. And then I went to the same advisors and they were like, your application's gold. Like, yes, you should definitely apply. Like, we back you all the way. We're going to write you a letter. And they were wonderful. And a lot of that was because my master's in public health GPA really boosted, even though I had a good GPA coming out of college, it just really boosted it enough to make it into the cutoff of what was, you know, and knowing there's a lot of things that were happening behind the scenes that I as a person hadn't changed. My ability to study science hadn't changed. I did fine and I did well and I thrived in medical school. It's not that it wasn't, there was a lot thrown at me all at once. And it was, of course, we all experienced this, but it was fine. And I did well on boards and, you know, all the way on. And so I think that if you are a pre-medical student and you hear that from someone who's a leader, you may think that that is set in stone, but just knowing that that's a single assessment of you at a single moment in time, and that doesn't define who you are. That doesn't, you know, and I think when I was a medical student, I really would look around and be like, am I really meant, am I good enough to be here? I was told that I wasn't. Am I right? And now you're in a residency position. Am I really good enough to be here? And I think all the way along, that's going to happen no matter what. But I think that certainly happened with me in my training, because I was always questioning if I was really good enough to be there, despite having objective data that I was. And so I think if anyone else is facing that, just know that that is just a single moment in time, whether that's a board score that doesn't go the way you want it, or that's a test that doesn't go the way you want it, or it's a person telling you that you're not good enough. Just remember that's a single person's assessment of you at a single moment in time. And that does not get to stop you. It doesn't get to define you, right? And so for me, what became discouraging ended up, I don't know if it gave fuel to fire. It allowed me to explore things I wouldn't have otherwise explored. So grateful for that time where I got to study public health and I got a different perspective on global health and connect with, you know, living in a place where we took bucket showers and flushed the toilet with a bucket of water and didn't have much electricity and used a mosquito net, and living for a year in a very resource limited setting, it taught me a lot about life and what matters in life, and about the value of public health and the value of just, you know, just human kindness, right? And I think I learned a lot from that experience. I wouldn't change it looking back, but I do think that for a period of time, it did definitely, that interaction with that advisor definitely affected how I perceived myself.
Yeah. I just so much appreciate and want to emphasize that point that, you know, the piece of paper and what's on the paper are maybe the hurdles we have to jump through, but your point that it's a moment in time and that what your paper was had changed, but you had not changed. I think it's just so important to keep in mind and something to think of for anyone who may be struggling out there. I know we're starting to come up towards the end of our time. I know we covered so much. I don't know if there's anything there we missed that you just want to make sure you get out there for any, you know, moms out there who may be struggling, or really anyone who's just trying to figure everything out.
Yeah, I think that especially as a woman in medicine, there's a lot of guilt and shame about your work, especially as it relates to your career. And you feel like you're kind of getting it from both sides of, I'm just not good enough, or I'm defective as a mother or as a spouse. And then at least a lot of my colleagues that are in different fields, they feel it at work. Like they're not seeing patients fast enough, or they're not working hard enough, or they're not good enough in their role. And I just would say to that person that you are doing such important work. You are loved. You are, your child, even if they can't express it to you in this moment, is proud of you and is so lucky to have a parent who not only loves them and values them and is brilliant, but also is going to be so proud of who they are and is going to have all these doors open to them and these resources open to them because of the hard work that you've been through. And so I hope that you can find I don't want to use the word balance, but just the right pathway that you can really stand clear on what matters to you and your priorities and craft a clinical career that's meaningful, but also in a way that allows protection for the things that matter most.
I love that. You're like going to make me tear up. I think I cry every single time I record an episode. But truly, thank you so much, Laura. You are doing such important work and really moving the needle. And I think doing exactly what you set out to do and creating that community and inspiration and just making things better so people can be great doctors and great moms. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Allie, for your podcast and for just having these hard conversations. They're so valuable.
Thank you as always for listening. If you liked today's episode, please subscribe and leave a rating or a review. It really helps people find the show. If you have someone you think would be a great guest or just have some general feedback, you can email me at momsofmedicine@gmail.com. Tune in again in 2 weeks for the next interview.